But I was fascinated by these moments in his life that I could see quite clearly in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating 10 years of podcasting in 2021. I'm William O'Flaherty, and today I only have the role of getting things started and wrapping up at the end, in addition to producing the show. As I've done on occasion, I asked Dr. Sarah Waters to play the role of host today, and she is interviewing New York Times bestselling author Patty Callahan. Sarah is talking with Patty about Once Upon a Wardrobe, a new work of fiction for 2021.
Welcome to All About Jack.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Great. So let's start with a kind of general question. How and why did you decide to write Once Upon a Wardrobe?
It's a very meta question, right, Sarah? Because it's asking me the origin story about an origin story. And the reason I can never clearly say, I think that's a bit of what the book is about, is that we can never clearly say what a fictional story, you know, is about or where it came from. And I've long been fascinated by origin stories. In high school, I took Latin and studied mythology, and I love the origin stories of words and language and how story is built on story. But when I was writing my novel, Becoming Mrs. Lewis, I kept seeing these little breadcrumbs in C.S. Lewis's life that I could also see in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I wasn't interested in chronicling the entire Chronicles of Narnia. There are experts who do that a lot better than I can or ever would, who have spent their life studying the Chronicles. But I was fascinated by these moments in his life that I could see quite clearly in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So that's where the original germ of the idea came from. But I also put it aside for a while, not thinking that was a book, but just thinking it was interesting. But usually, if I'm curious about something, it eventually turns into a book. And I wrote a book in between Mrs. Lewis and Once Upon a Wardrobe. But these moments in his life that I started to see unfolding, I knew that there was a story built in there.
So how and why did you settle on the idea of kind of blending the fictional with the biographical in this work in particular? Obviously, this is something that you did in Becoming Mrs. Lewis as well. How did you settle on that kind of concept?
I don't know if there was any other thing to settle on, because that's what I do. I write fiction. I'm a storyteller using the medium of fiction. I think the only nonfiction published piece I've ever written, aside from personal essays, is my thesis when I was in graduate school to be a pediatric nurse. So my medium is fiction and short stories and novels. And for me, the power of story in fiction is a way to have people read and know, and more importantly, feel in a different way than they would in nonfiction. For example, with Joy Davidman, you know, her biographies had been out for quite some time before I wrote that novel, but not as many people would pick up a biography that is, both of those biographies are amazing, by Abigail Santa Maria and Lyle Dorset. But unless you're studying Lewis in a scholarly way, you usually aren't going to pick up a biography about his wife, but a novel about their love story is a different medium and introduces a story in a different way. I always say, you know, scientifically, even medically, we are made for story. Our brains are wired for story. We have a human proclivity to understand the world through story. And for me, I wanted to tell not only the story of the genius, fiery, and yes, complicated woman, Joy Davidman, but I wanted to show how Lewis's life showed up in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and not tell you how his life showed up in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There are some really wonderful books out there, like Into the Wardrobe by David C. Downing. And you'll have an index and you can say, what does this mean compared to what does this mean? And what is the date? But facts don't change our hearts. Facts don't move us. Story is what moves us. Story is what, you know, kind of hooks our brains and brings us in to emotionally connect to something. So there was never a chance I was going to write this as a biographical or nonfiction piece. If I was going to write it at all, it was going to be as a story that you could emotionally connect to, or hopefully emotionally connect to.
Oh, definitely. Well, at least I did.
Awesome. That matters to me. So that's great.
No, I mean, I agree. I think that there's, I mean, and also Lewis would absolutely agree that the way to changing people's hearts is through stories, and the way to connecting with people, there is only so far an academic book can go, right? Academic books are great, but they have by nature a limited audience and by nature a limited capacity to change someone's heart. Well, and Lewis does a lot in his academic stuff, but it's limited.
Yeah, and I love that you said that, because you know, it's one of the things he talked about when people asked why he wrote a certain way. He said it was to sneak past the watchful dragons. And that is what fiction does. And yet a lot of the fiction we write, especially what I write the last 8 years or so, I cannot do without the scholarly books. They are, you know, vitally important to the story I want to tell. So this is not an either or a black and white. This is an and both. I think to understand some stories fully, it's interesting to read, for example, with Joy Davidman, it's interesting to read her poetry, then her biography by Abigail, then her biography by Lyle, then my fictionalized version of their improbable love story, and then watch Shadowlands, right? Each of those touches the story in a different point. So it's not an either or, it's just my medium.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're different paths into the same story, perhaps. Yeah. Different ways in.
Different streams into the same river, I guess.
Absolutely. Excellent. Great. And kind of linked to that, I guess. So I noticed various points, and this is a very geeky question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
I love geeky questions. It's perfect.
You import several Lewisian phrases kind of threaded through your narrative, which I really liked, because I was kind of like, I've noticed another one. So there's particular ones very early on, for instance. And I was kind of wondering why you decided to include these sorts of nods.
I'm so glad you noticed them, but I can tell you right here, right now, they weren't on purpose, meaning I didn't pull out certain phrases and put them on index cards and say, make sure to include these. Now, there are things I do that for, especially dates or books that were published, or I will have a don't forget to add list. And I will keep it at the bottom of the document. And it is things that I want to make sure that when the manuscript is finished, that I go back and add them, or that they're already in there. But what I think has happened in the past 10 years or eight to 10 years that I have been researching this man's life obliquely, not scholastically, but obliquely, meaning by studying Joy Davidman, I'm, you know, learning about him, and by studying his life in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I'm studying him. And for me, when I'm studying someone or something, primary sources are the best sources, meaning I want to read what he said, not what somebody said about what he said. I want to read what he wrote, not what someone else wrote about what he wrote. So, you know, in reading a lot of letters, essays, work, books, I think eventually after 8, 9, 10 years, you start to absorb this kind of cadence and language that he might use. Of course, I would never get it fully right, which is why, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but which is why I don't have him telling you the story in the book. Max McLean has him down, right? Cadence of language, the exact phraseology he would use. I will never have that down exactly right. And yet, if you read him enough, you know he might say it this way. He would use that word bound. He would, but it was never a purposeful, like pulling threads out of his own work, but more an absorption of the work that I'd read.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it shows that it's not sort of just completely imported kind of cut and paste job. It feels much more fluid than that. I just noticed them because I'm interested in those kind of things, I think. And yeah, absolutely. From a similar perspective, I suppose, the more you absorb his writings, the more you kind of can hear his voice coming through when people are writing about him or engaging with him in different ways.
Well, we were talking off air with William for a moment and with you about misquotes. And I feel like even now after all these years, when I see one, I can almost feel it close, but that's not exactly, like I can't nail why it's not right, but it's not.
Yeah, it is, but something is missing. Something is not quite.
I'm essential Lewis-y. Yeah.
Absolutely. Excellent. Great. So, and this is partly because I read A Wrinkle in Time for the first time this year, but I noticed a few moments in the text that really reminded me either characteristically or kind of more, I guess, partly in terms of style, that reminded me of A Wrinkle in Time, particularly the kind of logic meets imagination thing that we see with Meg's. So I was wondering if you might be able to talk a little bit about this or any other non-Lewis influences on the text you want to talk about.
Wow. I love that you noticed that. And yet, again, that wasn't on purpose at all. In fact, A Wrinkle in Time didn't enter my mind a single time while I was writing this book. And yet, I love A Wrinkle in Time. And I love Madeline L'Engle. And one of my great sadnesses is that I never met her. And there was, I think there were two separate chances where I could have, and I didn't because of like I had young children and I kept thinking I'll meet her another time. And then of course, another time never came. And I'm a very big fan of her work and her thinking, like her deep thinking about logic and imagination. And my favorite book of hers is called, it's not her nonfiction, it's called Walking on Water. I don't know if you've read it, but you're nodding. Yeah, it's amazing. Anyone who wants to go into a creative field, I tell them to read that book. In fact, talking about it makes me want to read it again. But, you know, her, so I am sure that through the years, I have absorbed some of that. How do we reconcile logic and imagination, right? So the way I see George and Meg's is they represent these two facets of ourselves. We have both in us, right? And we can allow one to dominate to the detriment of ourselves. If we only rely on logic or only rely on imagination and fanciful thinking, neither one of those do us any good. We have to find a way to meld them and reconcile them. And when I was about halfway through the book of Once Upon a Wardrobe, when I was writing it, it hit me that George represented logic or logos, and that Meg represented mythos. I mean, other way around. George represented mythos or myth and imagination, and Meg's represented logic or logos. And mythos and logos are the two words for word at their roots. And when I noticed that, I wanted to find a way to marry them together, to meld them. And the way that you can bring together logic and imagination is with love. And they loved, they were had their flags planted on two different hills. And yet they loved each other so much that they were willing to try to understand the way the other was thinking. And one of my favorite quotes from, again, Joy Davidman, is when she realized life is too intense to be endured with logic alone. And I wanted Meg's to parallel that journey in some ways. But I think A Wrinkle in Time is another great example of this battle that doesn't have to be a battle between the two. And one of my favorite quotes that Lewis has about imagination is that imagination is the organ of meaning. And so we can't do without logic. And I think we harm ourselves if we do without imagination.
So we were talking at the beginning about where I live, and I happen to live in Oxford. So I really like the way that you were able to capture Oxford both directly and I guess slightly more indirectly through kind of subtle metaphor comparisons and so on. So I was wondering why Oxford was so important to the story. I guess this is kind of obvious. And what you wanted to capture when you were thinking about Oxford in your writing.
Well, can I begin by answering by saying I am envious that you live in Oxford. I know that no matter where we live, we still have to live our life and go to the grocery store and do our laundry and, you know, go to market. And yet there is such an essential, mystical, and magical quality to the city of Oxford. I don't want to explain why, because I don't want to ruin it. So because I don't know the answer of why it is so mystical and magical. Part of it has to do with its setting. Part of it has to do with its deep, deep roots in the medieval world. Part of it has to do with the river running through it. I don't know, but it feels out of time and out of place to any other city. When I take the train from London to Oxford and step off the train, I feel that I did more than travel down some train tracks for an hour and arrive in a different city. And it was really important to me that this book, Once Upon a Wardrobe, felt a bit like a fairy tale. Even though it's real and set in a real world, and there is no better city than Oxford to conjure up this idea of a fairy tale. And so even though my main character, Megs, is living in the very real world, making very real decisions and trying very hard to come to terms with a very real tragedy that's happening in her life, this city infuses her journey with a bit of a mystical quality. And I wanted to be able to feel that. And that wasn't hard for me to conjure because that's how I feel when I am there. And that you live there and feel like I did it justice means so much to me because I do love that city. If you can love a city, I do. Does it feel like that when you live there? I mean, do you still feel, I mean, yes, I know that you have to, sometimes you don't notice, but when you're running your errands or trotting off through a building that's 1,000 years old, like, do you feel it, even living in it day to day?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Sometimes you get maybe not hardened to the beauty, but you sort of forget it because you're just, you know, cycling to go to the library or something. But then this happened to me the other day. I was locking up my bike and I just glanced up and there was a hot air balloon floating across above the Bodleian Library, above Broad Street for those of you that know Oxford. And I just kind of looked around. Wow, it's just so beautiful. And you kind of forget it sometimes because you're just going somewhere, you know, you've got to be at work or you've got to do something. But it is, yeah, it's incredibly beautiful. And I grew up in Cambridge, so I've been spoiled. Oh,
you're spoiled. You're spoiled. Even just to be able to say, you know, I was locking up my bike at the Bodleian, like, come on.
Like,
only do that in a story.
I'm very lucky. But yeah, there's beauty everywhere, but Oxford has perhaps more bundles of it than elsewhere. Excellent, great. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how you present Lewis's parents in the text, because I thought this is something that is so often left to the side or kind of quickly brushed over and then moved on from. And I thought you dealt with it really, really interestingly and really well. You don't go with the kind of dismissiveness approach or the sort of angelic but 2D approach that we sometimes get, particularly with Lewis's mother. I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that and the comparisons that we get with Megs and his parents.
Maybe it comes from writing fiction where a story arrives better for me when I'm writing if I understand the backstory of my character. Who were they? What were their parents like? What did they want? How did they grow up? What were the values in their house? These are the things I ask myself about completely imagined people made up out of nothing. So why would I treat it any different for a very real person like Lewis? And there is a scholar named Crystal Hurd. I'm sure you all have heard of her, Dr. Crystal Hurd. And she does really in-depth work on Albert and Flora Lewis. And I have read her articles. I have talked to her at length about it. I had her read this book before it came out. She sent me an early edition of some work that just came out or is about to come out about the family. And it was important to me, especially with Flora, to be able to show the primal force that she was in his life, even without turning her into a Victorian era Irish mum, but this powerful force who had a math degree, who once wrote and was published, who finally fell in love with her husband because he supported her work and her writing, not because of some romantic endeavor. And these were important for me to understand who Jack is, not only as a child, but as an adult. What kind of woman does he resonate with? What does he think of a strong, smart woman? What does he, which I think is part of what happened with Joy. His mom was a prototype, as well as, of course, we all know Dorothy L. Sayers. But there's this idea that he has this foggy romantic childhood on a house overlooking Belfast Bay and a mom who reads him Beatrix Potter. But it's such a bigger picture than that. And I wanted to show that. I didn't want to tell you that. And so I wanted to show Jack coming down out of the attic or being called to dinner or going on holiday with a mom who would take him to Dunluce Castle on holiday and expose him to this wider world that would eventually, decades later, become Cair Paravel. So to dismiss his parents as kind of shadowy figures in the background on this misty Irish land doesn't serve the story or who Jack became and why.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. I think making them more integral as he's thinking through his kind of development and as he's telling these stories works really well as one of the many frames in the text.
Thank you. So
I work on Lewis and Shakespeare, which means that I've always been struck by the King Lear quote that resonates kind of throughout his life in interesting ways, I think, and perhaps most famously appears on Lewis's gravestone. But I was wondering why you'd included it and why you included it in the way that you did in the text.
Oh, I love that those are the two things you study, Sarah. That is so fascinating. I'm about to flip this interview around. I think that is so fascinating. I could tell from reading his biography and in other places that quote never left him. And obviously it never left his brother because it ended up on his tombstone. And his brother, of course, ended up in the same, they're buried in with the same headstone in the same church. And I kept thinking about that quote. And I kept thinking about the mystical and, synchronistic quality of it being on the calendar on the wall on the day his mother passed. And I wanted to show that stuck with him his whole life, because there are things like that stick with us our whole life. We see it once, it works its way into our work or into our songs or into our poetry. And if it ended up on his tombstone, I am sure it was in his life. And I don't know if anybody's ever sure who noticed it on the wall, his father or him or Warney, but I write fiction, so I can make it be him.
Yeah, it's your prerogative, right?
I love how those two lives overlap in that moment, Shakespeare and Lewis. you know, of course, Lewis is 9 years old on that day. So he has no way of knowing that his life and Shakespeare's life will in some ways intersect as far as their impact on people, the way they're studied, their words, their stories. And how fascinating is that, that this young boy looks up, notices it, and here we are all these decades later talking about them in the same sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Perfect. So I was just wondering why you'd selected the name Devonshire. So I could think that there was a literary critic at the time who had the surname Derbyshire, Helen Derbyshire, perhaps quite well known. But I'm guessing this probably isn't why you picked the surname. So I was just wondering why you decided to go for that surname. It's probably not exactly that relevant in the grand scheme of things, but I was just intrigued.
Sometimes I'm very deliberate about name choices, and sometimes they come to me out of nowhere. And George Henry Devonshire showed up with that name. And I don't know. That's the fascinating answer. I don't know. He came with that name. And even our pal David C. Downing read the book and said, you might want to change the last name because that's actually a city. And people might get confused and think they live in Devonshire. I was like, yeah, no, they came with that name and they're keeping it. So, but I can tell you a little Easter egg or little hidden things in their names. And that is that the main character, George, I have my father's name and my son's name is George. And my daughter's name is Megan. That's where Megs came from. And my middle son is Patrick, and my husband is Patrick, and there's a Patrick. I don't usually do that, but I used my family's names in a way that I usually don't. And at first it wasn't on purpose, but then it became on purpose. When I realized that George and Megs were George and Megs, I was like, I better add a Patrick.
Otherwise, you'd be in serious trouble.
I know, right? Leave out my husband and my middle son. I wouldn't hear the end of that. So
I feel like given the kind of family threading that happens in the tale, then it's appropriate, right? In perhaps ways that it's less appropriate otherwise.
It's more personal than most of my stories. Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Perfect. And the next question, I mean, we kind of touched on this a little bit, or you touched on this a little bit earlier, but you thread emotion throughout your writing. I'm not just talking about this text, though, particularly this text, I think. You take us on these kind of journeys which are full of these sort of emotional tugs and pulls, which trigger both happy tears and sad tears, or at least in my case, when I was reading your text. And this is also true of Becoming Mrs. Lewis, I think. And I was wondering if you could maybe give the listeners some kind of insights or just something about how you kind of approach this, how you managed to capture that so well in your writing.
Well, thank you. First, thank you so much. It's really important to me because the magic of story is that it is transformational. And if we're going to show the transformational journey of a character, for me, there are different kinds of stories in the world. But for me, the transformational journey of my characters is as internal as it is external. And I imagine those transformations running alongside each other like two train tracks running next to each other. And you can't have just the plot moving forward. We can't just have Meg's interviewing Lewis, telling her brother the story, like that's the plot. That's what's happening next and next. But her internal transformation needs to be running along right next to it. And if I'm going to have that internal transformation, I need to understand about my character, what do they want? Why can't they get what they want? What are their wounds? What are the things they believe that aren't true? These internal things that define us. I think in a bit of a way, as an author of fiction, we get to play psychoanalyst. What is the deep down issue? Why is Meg's this way? And how can she change by the end of the book? So the simple answer is that I want the internal transformation to be as powerful and run alongside the external plot and change.
And we've kind of touched on this all the way through, but I realize that I haven't asked about it, so I probably should. This text centers around different, well, there's lots of different frame narratives, basically. There's all these different kind of intersecting frames in the story, which for those of you that haven't read it yet, it will make a lot more sense when you start to read it,
which you should today.
But we've got the kind of Lewis's story, Lewis's plural, and also Lewis's kind of possessive as well. And then we've got the George and Meg story. And then there are some overlapping stories which kind of intersect with those as well. But as you said, these are running on parallel, but kind of distinctive tracks as well. So we've got the sort of double tracks within each framing as well. So I was just wondering why you decided to frame the story in this way, or have your pairs in this way, however you want to interpret the question.
It's a great question because it was the hardest thing about this book. When I first decided to write it, or first thought there might be something interesting in it, to go back to our very first question, right? Why now? I became fascinated by the origin story of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And to show that, I had seen these breadcrumbs of his life. So I chose the 7 moments in his life that I could see in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Not the 7 from a scholarly work or the 7, because I had this great discussion with David C. Downing, and asked him, would you have chosen different events in Lewis's life than the 7 I chose? But those are the 7 I chose. So then the next hurdle was, how do I show those without telling them? How do I show these 7 moments that end up in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe without Lewis lecturing us, without Lewis sitting down with Megs? So Megs goes to Lewis and she says, my brother needs to know, where did Narnia come from? And she wants a simple answer. She just wants to be given a simple answer to take home to her very ill little brother. But when she asks him, he starts to tell her stories. And when I first began working on the book, Lewis was telling her the stories and I was bored. And I thought, if I'm bored, the reader's bored. And not that Lewis's life is boring, but nobody wants to read a man lecturing a young girl. So I spent some time thinking about what that might be, how to show that as a scene in your mind, but also how to show it so that we aren't again seeing a moment in Lewis's life through his eyes. We can read Surprised by Joy for that. So I decided to do it this way. Lewis tells Megs the story. Megs writes it down in her notebook. Megs reads it to her little brother. And we see those moments in Jack's life through the eyes and the imagination and this sweet liminal space of an 8-year-old. So an 8-year-old boy's eyes and imagination are showing us these moments that you can see in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm not telling you these moments are there. I'm showing you through an 8-year-old's imagination. And as George starts to hear more of these stories and we see them through his eyes, George starts to see a lion everywhere. He sees someone watching over him. He feels, and that way, these magical moments that end up in this story of the 4 children who walk through a wardrobe door isn't just about facts. It's about the transformation of the ordinary through the alchemy of story into the extraordinary.
Excellent. Yeah, and that goes back to the kind of idea that story itself, it has this huge transformational capacity, right? And lectures don't. I wish they did, believe me. I give enough lectures to wish they did, but they don't.
Yes, exactly. Not in the same way. We still need them though, Sarah. We still need them.
We do need them. perfect. So I've mentioned, or we both mentioned Becoming Mrs. Lewis a couple of times. I guess it might be helpful for you to just briefly give a little pricey for listeners that aren't familiar with that work. And also There have been hopeful reports that potentially it might be being adapted at some point. So if you might be able to share a little bit about that too, that would be great.
Becoming Mrs. Lewis is the fictionalized, but based on solid research, improbable love story of Joy Davidman, the New York born and bred, fiery, intelligent, genius, poet, mother of two young boys, married, an atheist. This improbable love story of this complicated woman and C.S. Lewis. And I became fascinated by her when I realized that their decade-long friendship and then love story and then marriage had influenced his work so profoundly, and that she had been in many ways shoveled off to the side as the woman behind the man or the inappropriate wife, which would have been another great title. And yet that he loved her so profoundly that he wrote that book, A Grief Observed, about her. So that's where that book came from. That's what it's about. And yes, there is something in the works, but nothing to announce. There is a production company with a man named Todd Komernicki, who produced Elf and screenwrote Sully. And we have a pilot and he is searching for partners. So it is in the works, but there is nothing solid out there yet. And trust me, when there is, I will shout it from the mountaintops, because if there is a woman who deserves a mini series about her extraordinary life, it is Joy Davidman.
Absolutely. Yes. We'll shout about it too. Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, Sarah, it is so much fun talking to you. It went way too fast. Thank you for having me.
Thanks also goes to you, our listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack, one of the many resources from EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of this show. All About Jack is celebrating 10 years of podcasting in 2021. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including various articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written, as well as for previous episodes of All About Jack. Also, consider checking out my YouTube channel, Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard an interview with Patty Callahan, conducted by Dr. Sarah Waters. It was about her new book for 2021 entitled Once Upon a Wardrobe. You'll find a link in the show notes about getting a copy, along with a link to her website, which we forgot to mention during the show. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him. Some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.